Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
Hey, y'all, this is Tommy. I just wanted to let you know that today's episode is a recut version of the conversation I had with Dale Earnhardt Jr. last March. We've done some editing and reshaping, so it might sound a little different to you. But we thought it might be a good time to re-air it with the Daytona 500 coming up on February 17th. So you'll hear Dale Jr. talk about his mixed emotions about retiring and his relationship with his legendary dad, Dale Sr. He also talks about getting ready to become a father, which happened just a few weeks after we talked. He and his wife, Amy, had a baby girl named Isla back on April 30th of last year. So now, from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound.
I was really impatient, very short, easily frustrated. I don't feel like that I have those days anymore. I don't feel like that I have that response to people anymore. I feel like that I'm a lot more flexible and a lot more understanding and a lot more forgiving and hopefully more pleasant to be around.
Dale Earnhardt Jr. has a heightened sense of self-awareness. That was a useful thing on the track in his long and successful career as a NASCAR driver. Off the track, it made him nervous and anxious and sometimes hard to be around. He has spent the last few years doing a lot of growing up, partly in response to a series of concussions that led him to retire, and partly because he fell in love and wanted to start a family. Dale Jr. is one of the most open and honest people I've ever interviewed. Here's our conversation. So now, you know, obviously for most of your adult life, you are on the track showing up every week as a driver. And now you're not. And now you're showing up at the track as a spectator, a race car, a team owner in some of the series, and then later on this year as a broadcaster. So now you've gone back a few times. What's the stuff you miss and what's the stuff you don't miss?
The stuff that I miss is usually really simple, you know, things. We were watching the Vegas race, and I miss running the high side at Vegas. I'd love to have been able to hop out there and run, you know, so 20 or 100 laps just around the high groove and had a little fun.
Right.
But I don't, you know, I don't miss trying to get through the bumps in turn one on the bottom, you know, and I appreciate how slick the track is and how it challenges drivers to try to get through the corners. We saw Jimmy Johnson getting into turn three underneath the car, turn sideways and kiss, you know, barely get into the apron a little bit, and just really an amazing save. And you, that right there was help you really understand just how slick the track is and how hard it is for these guys to get around there. I appreciate that, and I miss that challenge, but I don't actually miss the act of trying to do it because it's really hard, you know, and frustrating. Like driving race cars would bring out the worst in you from a personality and attitude standpoint, because driving a car is hard and it's frustrating most of the time. So a lot of times your attitude while you're doing that and in and around the car all weekend, it would reflect that frustration. And life is so stress-free compared to where I was when I was a driver, and everything that I do now is so much more fun than it would have been had I been driving race cars. And I couldn't never unplug from that completely and not think about it all day. I couldn't enjoy it to the fullest because I would always think about, man, you know, this Friday I got to go to the track. We got to qualify. Man, we qualified like crap last week. I hope we qualify better. I'll probably text Greg and see how he's going today. And, man, I hope we practice better. I remember where we ran good last time. I hope we can run good again there. You know, you just couldn't shut it off. I'm not the kind of person that, like, sees the positives in everything or has this great disposition. I would always hoping for the best but preparing for the worst. And I noticed this when I got hurt in 2016 and I got out of the car. And I didn't have to worry about going to the racetrack the next week. My doctor was like, you need to get rid of all your anxiety. Don't even think about racing. Just go live your life. Forget about anything that's going to bug you. And so I did. I completely forgot about racing. I didn't even think about it or worry about it. And when I did that, I realized, wow, you know, this is what retirement's like. This is going to be, you know, when that happens, this is going to be a nice change of pace for me. And I don't have to worry about performance, living up to potential, my expectations, everyone else's expectations. I don't have to worry about every week trying to hit that target.
I remember you talking to me about being that thing in particular, that worrying about how other people might judge you, and then leaving, and that being sort of like how you judge yourself.
Yeah.
Have you felt like that's eased off?
It certainly has. Now that, I mean, I wanted to run well. If I'm going to go to the track, I want to run well. And I know that when I go race, the only race I got on the schedule this year is at Richmond in the fall in the Xfinity Series. And I know no matter how much I try to go into that just having fun, I'm going to get competitive. You want to get competitive.
Right.
And so all those old feelings of, man, I should run in the top five. You know, I should be able to run top five. That's a reasonable objective. I better meet that. If I don't, I'm going to be mad. I think everybody else should expect that. That's probably what they expect. I'm going to be mad that I didn't meet that goal for them, for me, whatever. You know, I'm going to put that pressure on me. I know I will. I don't have that pressure every single week no more. That's nice not to have that anymore. I do miss that in a weird way, that competition and that striving to be better at something or that needing to hit a target or but I think that as I get into broadcasting, I will find ways to find challenges in that and ways to measure my performance and expect more of myself and push myself. But it is nice to really kind of be free of all that performance pressure.
There's been a several year sort of, you know, long-term decline in ratings and things for NASCAR. Do you feel like the sport is kind of in trouble in any way? And if so, what are some things that you would do, you know, to if you were in charge tomorrow, how would you change things?
I don't think the sport's in trouble. Obviously, they'd love to have great ratings. They'd love to have corporate sponsors spending $20 to $40 million on each team. And they'd love to have 50 cars showing up to every race. But NASCAR will always be around, no matter in what form. It'll always be around. We're not going out of business. Yeah, I think the numbers aren't great. I think everybody was surprised by the numbers for Daytona, and that sort of sets the tone for the next several months at least. I hope that they can trend in the other direction. But for now, it's been very disappointing. But there's a lot of things that are a plus or a positive for the long term. We talk about the young guys coming in, and we've talked about that a lot this offseason. That doesn't fix it overnight. What, if any, effect that these young guys have on ratings and attendance and so forth won't be felt in the next several months. That'll happen over 2, 3, 4 years.
So, as you've thought about being a dad, have you thought about the things that your dad did that you liked and enjoyed and want to continue with your child or children, as it may be, and the things you'd like to do differently?
Well, I definitely, she's not going to probably ever see me race. So I don't know if she'll have any connection to what I did as a race car driver.
You have to show old DVDs or something.
And right? She might not even care, right, you know, to see all that. That information will always be there if she really wants to dig into it. I'm not going to go out of my way to take her back into that, you know, that whole experience. I will probably be more excited about what she wants to do if it's unrelated to racing, because that'll be as interesting and new to me as it will be to her. If she wants to get into racing, I will want to help her and want to support that for sure. But I know how difficult that is. not only being a woman, but being an Earnhardt, that's like two strikes. That's just going to make it really challenging for her. So I definitely won't be trying to, you know, guide her in that direction with, you know, little go-karts and all kinds of things in her youth, trying to get her excited about it.
Do you feel like your dad did that?
No. My dad did not. I don't know how to say this without making it sound like he didn't care, but up until I was about 10 or 11 years old, he did nothing. You know, he did nothing in those first 10 years to introduce me to what he was doing, other than take me with him. And I had to beg to go to the shop. I would beg to go to Mamaw's house where his Sportsman or Xfinity shop was. And I was in the shop some, but mostly it was to play with the other kids in the neighborhood. You know, there was no go-kart in the yard. I got a go-kart at 12 years old. That was kind of young back then. You know, guys weren't putting their sons in carts at 5 years old like they're doing today. But even with that, he didn't spend any time with me really showing me what I was doing. I think he went to the go-kart track with me in my first race. I don't think he saw another race after that. He never saw any of my late model races. I ran 159 late model races, and to my knowledge, he never saw one of them. He was like, you know, I got a lot of shit going on. I got a lot of stuff happening. I don't have time to hold your hand here. If you like, you know, want to try street stock racing, here's an article in the Shaw Observer. They're starting a series. Read up about it. You and your brother go figure it out. That was it. We read the article. We went and bought a car, me and my brother. We built the motor, and we took it to the racetrack. Dad did weld the cage in because he insisted to do it because he knew we would weld it in there and it'd pop right out. But he didn't go and turn a bolt on the car. You know, he wasn't like, hey, you know, is it loose? Is it tight? He wasn't like that. You know, I watched Steve Letarte with his son. He's in there working with his little, you know, go-kart and setting it up and helping him race and going to all the races every week. Dad was more like, I'll try to provide what I can, but you got to take it there. You got to take it and use it. You know, he didn't have time to go invest personal time in it.
So how do you see yourself as a dad? You see,
I don't know. I really don't know. I think that with, I think being this old, I'm 43. I say being this old, I think being retired from driving and out of that circle, that cycle of going all the time and traveling so much. I mean, I know I'm going to be going to broadcast races, but being a driver, I think, and raising a child would have been different. Not quite as easy. And so with driving out of the way, for lack of a better way to say it, I think that I'll be able to be a little more hands-on. And if I do want to get involved in what she's doing, I mean, I watch, and she's being a girl, you know, I'm going to probably be a whole lot more hands-on with her than I would be if my son, you know, if I have a son one day. I'll probably be a lot more like my dad as far as like, you know, here's the golf club, you figure out how to swing it, you know, and I'll stand back and watch and tell you whether you're doing it right or not.
Right.
But with my daughter, I'll be a little more, you know, I'll help her a little bit more, I think, because with sons, you just try to, you're so hard, you know, on them because you expect them to be automatic. You expect them just to figure it out.
Right. Well, I wonder, though, if, you know, maybe it's better to treat the son more like you might treat the daughter.
Maybe.
And vice versa.
I don't know. Yeah. I'm really going to take my lead from Amy as far as what she expects out of me. I know what I'm going to feel emotionally and how I'll feel a certain way and I'll want to. But I'm going to also listen to my wife as far as how, you know, how she wants me to react in certain situations and whether she thinks I need to get in there a little further and be more involved or not.
Yeah.
We got to do this as a team.
You know, you used to talk about, have talked to me about sort of borrowing trouble and sort of pre-worrying about things before they happen. Has this happened with you as parenting? Are you anxious about it? Are you excited about it?
I'm all that. I can't wait to change diapers and be, you know, get in there and do.
Oh, you say that now.
I'm really feeling that way. I've already changed diapers on, you know, on my friends' kids. You know, it doesn't bother me. I like that. I like the idea of being a father and doing those things, you know, and it's nothing for me to change Wyatt's diaper, my nephew or whatever, you know, I wouldn't think anything of it. Something needs to be done. I know some of my friends didn't want to do that or weren't interested in getting up in the middle of the night and taking care of those things. But I feel like I'm going to want to do those things and I'm going to want to be involved. And for me to have a connection to my daughter, I think it'd be good for me to be doing those things, for her to see me as a provider and somebody who's active in her life and doing things for her and early on, I think will really help our relationship and our connection. But, you know, when we first got pregnant, I was excited and I wanted to go ahead and get to work on the nursery and boy, you know, I was just ready to go. And Amy is like, you know, let's wait. Why do we got to? We don't have to do that right now. And I'm like, well, you're not going to be comfortable at 7, 8, 9 months. And you're not going to want to try to design a nursery and order furniture and whatever, you know, these things in this last part of your pregnancy. Not that I have any experience with that, but I'm just thinking, you know, wouldn't you want to do it now while you feel, you know, like you can move about a much easier? But she's so I was a little anxious and anticipating a little bit too much. And so I learned a lot of things in this experience. And one of the most important things that I learned is to communicate with Amy as much as I can about how she feels about certain things instead of trying to take the lead on it. She'll tell me when it's time to start designing the nursery or ordering things. And she'll ask me what I think about this and that and the other, and when she needs that information. And
I saw you caught some grief recently for eating the last of the ice cream in the house.
I did. She
were you headed out of town or something?
No, I just was up in the middle of the night and was looking for something to eat. It was thin pickings in there. And there was like a little bit of a half a bucket of a little cut, one serving ice cream. There was about a half of that left, and I thought, man. But just as I did it, she wanted the ice cream as soon as it was. That's my luck. But it's been a good experience. I've learned a lot about us working together and us being a team. And I mean, you think that, you know, we got married and we've, you know, as you spend so much time with this person and you feel like that you're really working together well, you know, going through this pregnancy has exposed where we aren't as strong as we might have thought. And it's made those places stronger. And you're like, wow, I didn't know that we could work so well together. I thought we would always, I thought this was your personality and this was mine. And we would always sort of have to, you know, bend and flex with how we got along. But we get better and better at working together and thinking the same. And it makes everything a lot easier as we do that.
When we come back, Dale Earnhardt Jr. talks about his experience with concussions and how people now seek him out for advice. That and more ahead on Southbound.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
I also want to pass along a little information about the Queen City PodQuest, WFAE's competition to find the best podcast in the Charlotte area. We received more than 370 podcast ideas during the submission phase for the Queen City PodQuest. Which ones will make it to the final round for the chance to win a cash prize and a podcast deal at WFAE? You decide. Vote for your favorite podcast idea once per day until Sunday, February 17th on WFAE.org/Queen City PodQuest. Each week on Southbound, we take a moment to highlight our listeners. This week, I want to thank Karen Wall Porter, who tweeted about our episode with Janie Mines, the first Black woman to attend the Naval Academy. Here's what Karen said. I don't have words to describe the incredible Janie Mines.
She is my new Shiro. Thank you for introducing us to the finest amongst us during a time when all we see is the worst. Karen, thank you so much for those kind words. If you enjoy the podcast, we also want to hear from you. You can email me at ttomlinson@wfae.org or just tweet at me at Tommy Tomlinson. We'd also love for you to subscribe to Southbound and to leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. All those things help get out the word to more potential listeners. Thank you for all your support. And now, back to our conversation with Dale Earnhardt Jr.
I know you talked a lot about how she helped you when you were recovering from your concussions and all.
Yeah.
So are you done with that treatment now? Do you still go see a doctor about that? Where are you?
I don't go. I'm done. I got clear. Well, when I say I got clear, basically you sort of graduate, I think. And, you know, the doctor will tell you, he's like, I don't think I need to see anymore. And as long as everything's good, if you got any questions, give me a call. I got Dr. Mickey Collins is my doctor in Pittsburgh. And I can call him any day. And I do. I call him sometimes, and if I have questions or something comes up or.
So do you ever feel anything that feels like this might be a symptom or something like that?
Well, so I'm still really kind of weeding through that. And what I mean is before you ever have any problems with your body, you don't have any knowledge about concussions, you're oblivious to even thinking about it. You don't even, it never crosses your mind, right? Well, when you get hurt and you have sickness and illness, and we call it sickness and illness, but when you have these symptoms, you're starting to feel your sensors and senses that you never even thought to take notice of. You start to analyze yourself far more than you should. You start to understand and learn and gain knowledge about concussions and injuries and head injuries and how the brain works. You don't really need to know that stuff. With, you know, if you haven't had a head injury, you don't know it. You don't even think about it. So when you go through all that and absorb all that information and turn on all those sensors, you can't turn it off. It's like in racing, all the engineering and technology that we've learned, we can't unlearn it. It's here to stay. And so when I go around my day-to-day life, I feel things and sense things that I would never even have noticed before. And I don't know whether I just sense them because I've become so self-aware and overanalyzing myself every day. I don't know whether it's a real symptom or it's just something that I've learned to take note of and I can't forget.
So it could have been something that's been happening for years,
yes.
But you just now have that starting to notice.
Right. So, and my doctor calls it putting things in a concussion bin, and that's a bad habit. So if you forgot where you put your keys or what you did with your phone, my wife forgets where she put her phone at least once every day sometime during the day, right? And it'll be over there on the table. Or it'll be upstairs at her makeup table, whatever. And I probably do the same thing with my phone. But now that I've had this concussion, every time I forget where my phone is, I wonder if it's a sign of a problem. My doctor says you're putting that in the concussion. Everything you think that is a problem, you're putting in a concussion bin, and you got to stop that. That's just regular life. If you had a symptom of forgetting things from a concussion, then every time you forget something for the rest of your life, you're going to think, that's because I've had a concussion. When maybe it isn't. Maybe it's just something normal that was always there that's going to be there the rest of your life. So the problem is that if you've had a lot of different symptoms, then there's a lot of things that you're going to always think about and acknowledge and analyze every single day. I had a lot of symptoms with my eyes. And so I find myself every day sort of testing myself if my eyes are working right. And it drives me bonkers. There'll be days when I wake up and things are a little blurry and I think, man, is this just me and I'm going to have these problems the rest of my life? And it turns out that I just needed to give myself an hour to get woke up and my vision improves. I can't say for sure, like, hell yeah, I have symptoms every day, but when you go through that experience and you have to analyze yourself when you're ill, you keep on analyzing yourself even when you're well, and you always will. And those things that you learned about your concussion and trying to recover from it, you can't unlearn. You can't turn off all that.
So I think when we talked a year or so ago, you were had just sort of kind of opened up publicly about all that. And you were starting to hear from people who wanted to know what your experience is like, because they'd had similar ones. Mm-hmm. They want to know about your doctors and that sort of thing. Have you continued to hear from people and get their stories too?
Only really online. Actually, that's not true. I ran into a guy when I was at Daytona. This is a great experience for me. I walked into a guy in the middle of the garage, and he walked up to me, had his brother with him and his dad. And the younger boy was like, I read about your story. I was having all these problems and had been in an accident of some sort, and I'd had all these problems and couldn't figure out what to do. And I'd been to all these doctors, and I finally went to, you know, to Pittsburgh at the United Medical Center. And I got help from Mickey, my doctor. Oh. And he said, I finally, you know, got well, and I just got cleared in January. And here we are in February in Daytona. And he's like, I just got cleared last month, man. And it's awesome. I'm so happy. And I've been dealing with this and couldn't get in front of the right doctor. And I finally got in front of Mickey, and he fixed it. And so we cheered and laughed about Mickey for a minute, because Mickey's does amazing things, and he's a freaking miracle worker. We exchanged contacts so we could stay in touch and maybe see each other again somewhere along the racing circuit. I hear from people on social media from time to time asking me either questions about, hey, did you experience this, or where did you go, or they're over whatever issues they had, and they just want to share that they understand the challenges or the struggle with it. But yeah, I still hear from people, which is great. And I'll never understate my issues or my experience. I don't want people to think of me of, well, that's that guy that had that concussion, and man, you know, that's concussion guy. But I also want to help people, and I want to be involved in that conversation. And I keep my ear to the ground. I follow a lot of different handles on social media to stay abreast of the latest and greatest conversations and research and so forth. And I want to always kind of be aware of where we are in studying concussions and in trying to treat them. I also like to stay in touch with Mickey because I like to work with him directly if he needs me to go speak or be a part of a conversation anywhere. I feel like I owe him so much for being able to put me back together and bring me out of the fog I was in. So I love to be connected to him. And anytime anybody ever asks me to get involved in anything, if it's research or rehabilitation, or if it's a hospital over here or a doctor over there, I always call Mickey. And I always say, Mickey, this person's asking me to be involved in this. What do you think? And I don't do anything unless he gives me sort of his approval on it, because I don't want to ever do anything that's going to misalign me with his approach and his beliefs, and I always kind of want to be tied to him because I feel safe. You know, if I ever need him again, I want to know he's right there.
Right.
I love being able to explain to people, like, you know, how to get help, want them to feel less helpless about the situation than they feel, and positive about a part, you know, possible brighter future. It's a scary, scary place to be, you know, when you're not well and you don't think you're going to get well, and you've seen, you know, four or five guys that haven't been able to help you. You think, man, this is my life. This is it. I have to live with this. That is so scary. And so I love being able to point people in the right direction to Mickey, and I know that anybody I send over there, he's going to fix it. I know it.
I want to bring all this back around to one last thing.
Sure.
You talked about, you know, we've talked before, that when you were being treated for the concussion and you were recovering, that you felt like the person you were then,
oh yeah,
was sort of the best version of yourself.
Yeah.
That you were kinder, you listened more, paid attention to other people, all those sorts of things. Now that you're clear of that some, it's been a year or two,
mm-hmm.
how much of that person that you always wanted to be, do you feel like you've retained?
I feel like I've retained quite a bit of it, to be honest with you. I have a whole lot more patience than I had before, and that patience and my ability to, I don't know how to explain it perfectly, but I was really impatient, very short, easily frustrated. I don't feel like that I have those days anymore. I don't feel like that I have that response to people anymore. I feel like that I'm a lot more flexible and a lot more understanding and a lot more forgiving and hopefully more pleasant to be around. I think a lot of that was going through the concussion and understanding how I had become that person. I think a lot of it was shedding and away the layers of what racing was doing to me as a person. And it's my fault. It's not racing's fault. It's like my inability to handle, you know, what I was going through as a person. So I think being ripped away from that and having to go through the rehabilitation and all that in the concussion situation, I think it allowed me to see the error of my ways, you know, and make some adjustments. And so I'm glad that there was some positives to pull out of that experience, being out of the car. And that could have went so terribly wrong and been a very black time for me and a very dark time that I might be still stuck in. But it allowed me to get out of that stress and say, man, I wasn't handling that well at all. And I was not good to people that care about me. You know, I wasn't pleasant, and I was unpleasant there was no better way to explain it. I wasn't fun to be around. And I feel like that now I'm a lot more easygoing, and like I find myself in scenarios and situations, and I go through those experiences now, and I have no disruptions. I have no frustrations. I feel like that the people that are with me in those moments are not suffering from my personality, or I'm not making the situation unbearable. And I know that sounds crazy, I bet, but that's how it was. That's how things were for me. Me and Mike Davis have been working together for a very, very long time, and I always look at our relationship and how we work together and how we get along as sort of a good benchmark for where I am as an individual. Everybody loves Mike. Everybody gets along with Mike. If I can be around him and have a great experience, I think that I've made some good changes. And if I get around him and don't have a great experience and I make the experience bad for him, then I know that I'm not handling the situation the way I should. And when we worked together, when he was on the road with me, I think back to those times, and I think back to our arguments and disagreements, and I think back to that being a lot of my responsibility and how difficult I was to be around and work with. And so when we go to South Korea together and we spend a whole week together over there and never have one disagreement, never have one negative word toward each other, or not even a hint of a disappointment or unhappiness, I think that that says a lot about where I am today as a person. And I think it says a lot about some of the changes that I've made and the efforts that I've made to be a better person, to be a funner person to be around. It's gotten easier, you know. I think those changes would have been hard to make if I was still driving race cars. Because race cars I don't want people to think that I hated driving cars, because I loved it. And I'd still be driving cars if I hadn't got hurt, you know. But it did make me a miserable person, you know. It made me a less happier person, because I wanted to do so well. And there's a lot more downs, even for guys like Jimmy and Kyle that are so successful, even for those guys that win so much, there's still more downs than there are ups. There's more frustrations and disappointments in that job. And I didn't handle those well. You know, I didn't handle that pressure as well as I should have. to be out from under that, I think, is allowing me to have a better perspective and a better, every day's a little bit easier and lighter.
Driving was never the hard part for Dale Earnhardt Jr. It was his deep desire, not so much to win, but to make people happy and to live up to the legacy of his dad. It's good to see him on TV now, looking relaxed, and to see him on social media, loving on his baby daughter. In a story I wrote about him a couple of years ago, I said that sometimes a man has to go in circles to find himself. Dale Jr. did that for a long, long time. And I think he's finally found a groove in his life that brings him a little peace. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our producer is Nick Delacanal. Our audience engagement producer is Joni Deutsch. And our main theme music comes from Josh Turner. You can listen to this and every episode of Southbound on the NPR One app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. You can also find Southbound on WFAE.org, where each episode has show notes with more information on that week's guests. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com. Additional support is provided by the Knight Foundation.